What could make someone almost quit entrepreneurship? And what could draw them back into it? Welcome to Venture Voice, episode number 37. I'm your host, Greg Gallant, and today we have an interview with the CEO of Digg, Jay Adelson. You might have heard about Digg. It's a social news website, so anyone can submit an article to it, and then the community votes, or digs, which article should rise to the top of the heap. In essence, it's a disruptive business model that eliminates the need for editors. Very revolutionary, has picked up hundreds of thousands of registered users, millions of viewers, and the media is really starting to take notice. Business Week just featured Digg founder Kevin Rose on its cover, labeling him a $60 million man. Although there are some questions that we get into this interview about his actual net worth. But who's this man behind the scenes? Who is the CEO? Jay's got a really interesting story. He started Equinox, one of the companies that provides the backbone for the internet, which is now a large public company. But Jay himself didn't make all that much money off it, like some other people who we've talked to on this show, like Fabrice Grinda. He didn't cash out at the right time. The dot-com bust made all his shares worthless. And he was left pretty much, as he says, just enough money to put his kids through college. Was ready to swear off entrepreneurship, move to Dutchess County, outside of Silicon Valley, was ready to live the simple life, but Digg brought him back into the entrepreneurial world. Hear how Digg made Jay an entrepreneur all over again. Jay, welcome to Venture Voice.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for coming on the show. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got started with entrepreneurship? How do you kind of get into this whole tech entrepreneurship world?
Sure thing. Well, when I went to school, I went to school for film and broadcasting. I had no idea that tech entrepreneurship or any kind of entrepreneurship was in my future. I went to Boston University and had an incredible time there, learned just how to make movies, basically. I was focusing on sound engineering. I thought I would do that for the rest of my life. And I moved out to San Francisco after I graduated to try and get, you know, work in the industry. Did some work at, you know, various film houses in San Francisco area, like LucasArts and Saul Zant, Zoetrope, that kind of stuff, you know, where you'd be pushing the broom for the guy who pushed the broom for the guy who served the coffee kind of thing. And I really just couldn't break in. It's like nobody had any work for me. It was just really hard for me to pay my rent, living in, at the time, San Rafael, north of San Francisco. And I just eventually started doing temp work. Now, I should give you a little more background. I would be lying if I said I wasn't into technology to begin with. I've been a geek my entire life, and I've always been into things like telecommunications and computers, and I studied computer science in college as well as a minor or concentration, you know. So when I started temping, of course, you know, this is around 1992, I immediately began getting great pay and great jobs doing tech-related work for companies to just basically pay my rent while I was trying to make it in the film industry. It's just, you know, a function of timing and everything else. Every single time I would take one of these jobs, I'd be offered, you know, a salaried position. And I'd say, no, I'm pursuing my film career. I'll pass on that. And the numbers just kept getting higher and higher. And eventually, you know, it was really getting me down because I just couldn't make enough money doing this. And I was, you know, getting prepared to give up, at least for a while. And, you know, I went, you know, decided to cash out on my credit cards and travel around the world and just take a break from this because it was stressful. And when I got back, a friend of mine was helping to start the very first internet service provider in the United States. And he was looking for just somebody with Clue. Not with business experience. It wasn't a business role, but just somebody with Clue to come in to this new company called Netcom and just help them out in various different ways, you know.
You said someone with Clue?
Clue, right. So there's this idea, you know, that, you know, the specific educational background would help you one way or the other. ultimately, for a lot of new companies, the most valuable asset you bring is just common sense, you know, just the ability to learn a new, something new and to focus on it and to, you know, drive it to completion. And what I learned very quickly was, you know, I was pretty good at leading and, you know, bringing people together to, you know, a particular purpose. And NetComm really was a great experience for me because it taught me what my capabilities were. And from there, you know, I think from there I leaped into entrepreneurship and I started to want to do things myself or be involved with startups in one way or the other.
What about film? Isn't that where you want to make all your money, make your mark?
Well, film and broadcasting, you know, don't get me wrong, it's a passion and a love of mine. And I'm continuing to be involved in it. You know, while I'm CEO of Digg today, I'm also the founder of another company called Revision 3. And Revision 3 is very much focused on sort of the new media of film and broadcasting and what we call podcasting, as you are well familiar with, but also vidcasting and basically creating our own content, which can be distributed via any of these, you know, new technologies out there. The most obvious out there being iTunes or Odeo. And we're having a good time with that. It's actually becoming such a successful business on its own that it'll be closing funding soon with its own offices and its own staff.
Wow, that's a huge growth curve. So getting back to you know, your beginnings here, it seems like things have really come full circle, and now I know why you were so conscious to the sound engineering piece while we were setting up this call. But tell me about your first venture where you were the person who really drove it and was a founder in a very big way.
Well, I you know, from at least from my perspective, you know, I feel like my very first gig at entrepreneurship was the Palo Alto Internet Exchange, which was this research project that was within Digital Equipment Corporation back in 1996, 97. And I need to be specific in this case, because just for the record, it was a business unit that was evolved out of a research project in the Network Systems Laboratory, which was just an interesting sort of entrepreneurial feel to this laboratory in Palo Alto, where, you know, folks who were working for Brian Reed at the time, like two gentlemen, Stephen Stewart and Paul Vixie, both innovators in the internet, had come up with this idea for basically scaling the internet using a neutral exchange point that would sit behind all the networks that make up the internet and allow all the networks to connect to each other, like an international airport is to airplanes. It was for internet traffic. And when it sort of transferred to a business unit, I was brought on, you know, sort of as the person responsible for the technology of this startup within DEC, whereas the general manager of the business unit was a guy named Al Avery. So it felt like, you know, comparatively to everything else I had ever done before, a startup, because here was the CEO type, which was Al Avery, and me, who's really the CTO or COO, if you will, of the startup, where we were building, you know, this business from scratch. Eventually, it started to do well. It started to broke even and was making money. And, you know, we looked at each other and said, well, you know, there are flaws in this model. There's things we'd love to improve on, things that make sense, but we can't do this within Digital Equipment Corporation. It's just never going to happen. Too big a company. And that was when the two of us left to co-found our company called Equinix. And Equinix was a traditional venture-backed company that ended up going public 8 years. You know, it's been 8 years in operation, and it's been very successful.
So how did you manage that process? Like, as it grew, how did your role evolve? Were you always a CTO, had your head in the machine, or were you jumping all around? What was the feel like for you?
Equinix is it's kind of a dramatic story for me, probably less so for people around me. But whenever something's your baby, you have to sort of let your baby go, you know, in various ways. The first thing that happens is you cease being responsible for 50% of the day-to-day operations. And you have to hire people to do these things for you. And sometimes things that you honestly can do better than they can. It's going to happen. And it's just the nature of entrepreneurship is how you manage that that transition. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, really this is where it's very difficult for them. If you can if you can delegate without fear and do it in a way that rather than becomes a struggle for you where you're conflicting with those individuals you hire and your board and the venture, the VCs, if you could do it in a way that's complementary and where you end up being a leader for these people, then that can work. And I think at Equinix is a little of both. I think I was learning my chops on how to be a leader, and I think I gave up a little too much too fast. And as a result, I over-delegated. So by the time, 6-7 years rolled around and you looked at what my responsibilities were for the company, it had evolved to, coming up with new ideas and new products, but mostly evangelism. And that's not my forte. My forte is developing new ideas and being creative. So I wrote my own ticket there. I should have been a little bit more careful.
Wow, that's an interesting story, because we hear from a lot of entrepreneurs it's just really tough to delegate, and that often keeps them from scaling. On the other hand, to hear that you can over-delegate too, what's coming out of that? And I guess we'll talk in a little while about your current ventures, but what measure did you learn? Like, how do you gauge, like, okay, I'm spending time doing this. Should I keep doing it or should I delegate it? Like, how do you make those decisions?
Well, first of all, and this is probably the toughest piece, is you have to be aware of where your strengths are. I think that in my case, back in 1998, if there was some way you could have done a personality profile on me and figure out where are my leadership skills best suited, I think the answer would have been in operations and in technology-related issues. That's just the areas that I was strongest in, and to some extent, marketing and new product development. But not everybody has a very good understanding of their value. And I think mine came from very good mentorship years before that. So when I was learning how to be a corporate employee at NetComm, I had managers, their names that come to mind, like Craig Clemens and Bob Tomasi. These are guys who came from long experience in supply chain and operational theory. And I just picked up a lot of that, from my mentors, a lot of, skills, and also the ability to do self-assessment. So when I was at Equinix, I was doing that to some extent. So I was aware of what my strengths were. But, what's the metric? How do you know when you're over-delegating? I think it's more of a, unfortunately, a one-time decision. It's too late. I mean, once you give it up and someone builds an entire team, even if it reports to you, if you've given up too much, they place their signature and their method, which could be wrong or right, on that group. And for you to then try and intervene and take it back, that's the conflict that you just can't do. If you do that, you become a squeaky wheel. You end up being counterproductive to the company's success, and you end up losing your job, like so many founders do. And so really, you just have to be able to gauge that up front, and you have to make the right decisions going forward. And in retrospect, I probably made the wrong ones.
Wow. So you basically shoved yourself out of Equinix. Are you happy with how it came? Do you think it could be a bigger company today had you not over-delegated?
Well, in some ways, it probably would have been a smaller company. The choices I made were largely based on I wanted people with experience doing very big things, which I clearly didn't have at the time, to come and take those roles. And based on their resumes and based on where they came from, I did that. I hired the CEO. I hired the financial people. I hired these people, all incredibly skilled people who I have tremendous respect for, and they all did their jobs extremely well. But what they were very good at is building a giant billion-dollar company.
What's wrong with that?
Well, that's the question of success. You know, what maybe a better question should be, for me anyway, what did I want Equinix to be? And really, I wanted it to be a billion-dollar company, sure, but I think I wanted it to be something that was a little bit less commodity-focused, a little bit less focused on data centers and colocation. If you research Equinix, you'll see what it's all about. But and a little bit more focused on network services. Now, you know, that being said, Equinix is one of the best success stories out there on the internet. I'm extremely proud of what happened with that company. Its success on the NASDAQ, its success internationally. So I'm you know, framing this in an effort to be critical of this incredible success that I had. So I feel like it was a success. But looking back on things that I would have done differently, sure. I mean, there's a million things on my list. I think that that's important for any entrepreneur to do before they take the next step forward.
So it doesn't sound like you're an easy person to make content.
I'm never satisfied with myself. Never satisfied with myself. Never satisfied. You know, I look back at every decision, even the ones that were successful, and think, I could have done that better. Here's how. And I apply that to my next decision. And, you know, I think, you know, just in terms of how that worked for me at Equinix, the good decisions I made were based on my ability to know my own limitations and to, you know, certainly step aside when it was needed. I think where I made mistakes is where I maybe undervalued myself and didn't take responsibility for things I should have at the time. But, you know, we all, it's all part of a tremendous learning experience. I think going back to Equinix, the biggest thing I learned was how to work with the investment community and how to use that to fund a company and get your idea to make your ideas real.
So you IPO, that's usually a pretty nice exit. When you were done with that, you know, what kind of financial situation did it put you in? What were your options on the table, and what were you thinking about doing next?
Well, in my case, while I started with millions of shares of Equinix, the NASDAQ crashed in the middle of our entire effort. And while Equinix did not go bankrupt and did not have to restructure in the most traditional sense in the internet space, it did end up having a reverse split, a 32-for-1 reverse split. When that happened, at that point, I had already given up most of my responsibility in the company. I had stepped down, you know, as a team leader and was serving as the chief technology officer, although I technically wasn't even an officer of the company anymore. I hadn't been for some time. And I basically wasn't in a position to equalize that back. So when new options were issued, you know, I wasn't there on the receiving end. The people that I hired ended up doing, in some cases, 10 times better than I did in terms of the their result from cashing out Equinix stock and so on. Now, I'm not complaining. I mean, I did enough that my kids will go to college and will be paid for, and they'll have food on their plates. And I have three children, by the way. And I, you know, I feel successful financially, but I didn't make enough money that I would feel comfortable investing in companies or, you know, being an angel myself. I don't have enough for that. I have enough basically to protect the interests of my kids just barely. And, you know, from that point forward, I drive an 8-year-old car. You know, I never got the sports cars or no Ferraris. So I would say, again, I look at it as a success. And what it did was it gave me confidence and an understanding of really what is truly at risk when you start a company. And what I am amazed with is how long-term people plan when they're considering the risk of starting a business. If you're a creative person and you start a company and you get some funding, and let's say it's, you know, enough capital to burn for a year or two, what's the risk to you? You'll eat during this process. You'll be able to take home pay during this you know, try you make at having a successful business. Why not do it? Is the issue that you are worried about not having a job a year from now? Well, you don't have a job now, right? You're starting a company because, you know, hopefully one of the reasons is to build yourself your own career. So I don't understand why more people don't take this risk. It just seems like a no-brainer. And then, of course, if it's truly from your heart and your passion, you'll probably be successful. Or at a very minimum, make the relationships through that process so that your next try will be a success. You know, I don't think that unless you're truly incompetent, it's really hard to set yourself up so that you'll never get investment capital again. Now, I say that having never had an issue raising investment capital, but I'm saying that also just, you know, if you've got a really good idea, then you should run with it.
So we here at Venture Voice won't argue with that, but the cynic would say, you know, 70-80% of businesses fail. You'd need to invest a lot of your time and money before you'd even be in the potential to get outside funding, and only a very small percentage of the people who seek it get it. You know, what do you say to people who cite those type of statistics?
I think they're reading too many statistics. And I think that behavior is what drives people to sit, you know, and end up, you know, not funding their dream. It is true that there are a lot of people out there that confuse good ideas with good businesses. And that is a problem. When people go out and try and fund a good idea, they're often disappointed because, like you say, they haven't done enough work. There isn't, you know, working capital. There isn't revenue coming in. It's not proven. And most often, there's no business model. It's just a really good idea. Now, if you took the extra, you know, month or 6 months or whatever to develop your good idea into a business, and you can come up with comparable businesses out there that are based on some of the same fundamentals, then you have effectively enough to get what I would consider to be angel funding, and enough to get some kind of investment to at least get you off the ground. And that's when you're just cut, you know, taking a brush, you know, broad view of startups, because there's a whole different dynamic with new web startups, because new web startups don't require the capital to prototype, and they don't require the capital to test out and see if they're successful. Dig was $1,200 for us to determine it would be successful. And so, you know, so we're still talking about two different things here. The web startup is a very different animal than a more traditional startup.
So I want to get into that, but as promising as the web startup is, you told me before we started this talk that at one point you thought you were out of startups. You'd had it. You were sick of being an entrepreneur. You know, this rosy picture. What could ever drive you to that?
Well, you know, 8 years of Equinix drove me to that. I mean, I think, you know, what happened is this is something that was my idea that I felt that I was chasing. And it was my passion, and I put my heart and soul into it for 8 years. And 8 years later, you know, while I felt successful on many levels, because here was this incredibly successful company, personally, I don't feel like I achieved feeling of satisfaction. Personally, I felt under a great deal of stress. This company that had grown to like 600 people in five countries, where I just didn't feel in control of the direction the company was going, it created a lot of stress for me. And I felt, well, you know, really what's important to me is my wife, Brenda, and my kids, Rowan, Ben, and Lisa. And I need to, you know, just focus on that. And And, you know, I have enough money here that I know, again, my kids will go to college if they want, and I could pay for that. And you know, I've got enough for emergencies. And I could get by at this point with a much lower class lifestyle. So we made a decision to leave San Francisco and move to rural New York and basically find some very cheap land or cheap home, very low mortgage. And I would take a break, sort of phase myself out of that corporate rat race, and then find something local, like work in a coffee shop or seriously, you know, or go to teaching. Teaching has always been a fantasy of mine. I always wanted to be a teacher. My parents are teachers, and I just always felt like I would come back to that. And I got here, I got to New York, and, you know, this is, you know, where you sort of realize who you are, you know. I'm an entrepreneur. You know, I couldn't just let it go. My friend Kevin, who I met a number of years previously, and I had always, you know, had fun brainstorming business ideas, and Dig was one of those ideas.
How'd you guys meet, by the way?
Kevin was the host of a television show on tech TV called The Screensavers. And at one point, he was producing a segment, or he was certainly starring in a segment, which was explaining how the internet worked. And without getting into any, you know, tech gobbledygook, suffice to say that Equinix is important to that. If you shut Equinix off, the internet would stop working. So that's pretty important. And, you know, he wanted to get some kind of physical manifestation of the internet. So he came and did this whole segment on Equinix, and he ended up interviewing me. And I got to tell you, I looked at this guy and I saw myself from when I started Equinix years previous. And for some reason, it was just this, I don't know, I felt like, hey, here's my opportunity right here. I can give him all of my mistakes that I made and all the lessons that I've learned, which no one was able to give me, that I had to learn for myself. And I can give him all of those tools so he doesn't have to make the mistakes that I made. And I was enjoying that. I was really enjoying that. And we would come up with ideas and float them around. You know, he had come up with this idea for Dig, and I just kept trying to, you know, help him change what was a good idea to a really good business, right? And once he had that really ironed out, well, I just, you know, I pushed him over the edge and said, hey, you know, you got to go do this. You just have to just do it. And so he did. The rest is history.
Wow. So tell me the difference between the idea that he had, which you said wasn't necessarily fleshed out to a business, and ultimately the business model that you guys came up with that you've since pursued.
Well, sure. I mean, in this case, it's a relatively simple transition. And, you know, we had looked at sites like Friendster and, you know, even Napster, I mean, peer-to-peer and or social networking companies, things like MySpace, and this new acceptance of collaboration out there on the web. And we thought, okay, well, you know, search engines can only go so far because, we believed, Kevin and I believed, that there's a limit to what an AI or what a computer can really do. You've got millions of users that are obviously willing to connect to each other on the internet through these social systems and through these collaborations. Can't we apply that to filtering content and making content more usable and presented to you in a way that's more useful? We just didn't know what kind of content, number one. We didn't know whether or not we could drive the viral nature enough of it to generate ad revenue. Because one thing was clear from our perspective is that we couldn't charge users for this. That would never fly. So it would have to be an advertising-based model or some kind of transaction-based revenue. And, you know, at first, the initial discussion, well, it seemed like too niche of a website. And could we tweak the idea so that it really, if it caught on, it would catch on big? Also, what sort of content do you apply it to that's big enough to apply to a big enough audience that you'll have that advertising revenue? Originally, we were talking about, also, I won't even get into all the different things we were thinking about ranking, with user collaboration. And finally, we settled on news. And Digg's success was largely based on the fact that this is something that just caters extremely well to user participation and collaboration. So once that was the plan, then it was like, okay, Jay, go back to kicking back in New York and chilling for a bit, and I'm going to see if I can't get this thing prototyped, like you say. And within a few months, not only was it prototyped, but it was earning money. You know, it wasn't too hard for him to convince me to come on as CEO after that.
So luckily you hadn't found some great job at a coffee shop by that point.
I was still working at Equinix. So what happened is when I moved out to New York, I, relinquished what my responsibilities were for the company outside of evangelism and speaking on behalf of the concept. I would go to events and hold seminars. And I mean, I'm not doing Equinix a lot of justice here. It's an incredibly rich and complex business with an incredible vision and very important. And so, I still am passionate about that, very passionate about that. And so the idea was, is I would go to New York and I would phase myself out. So I was still doing that for Equinix for about a year I was getting a paycheck that way. And so I wasn't really starving yet to go get that coffee shop job. But it was coming, and it was clearly there was a transition coming. I guess what happened was, rather than go through that process, Digg was so successful and it was growing so fast that I was CEO of Digg, regardless of how much time it took of my day, and I just gradually replaced more and more of my time with Digg and took away time from Equinix until Digg became my full-time job.
So tell me a little bit more about that number that you said it took to start. $1,200, you said?
$1,200. Well, there's a debate. I'll tell you the real story. The real story is that Kevin, in order to prototype this thing, he needed a PHP programmer. And so he had worked in the past with a gentleman named Owen Byrne, who was living in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He found him through some kind of online process. I mean, literally, it was programmer for hire. And Owen's, I think his initial quote was something like $2,000. It was some number saying, okay, well, I'll, for this much money in a week or two, I'll give you a prototype based on the spec that you gave me. The thing is, the number always went up because Kevin was never satisfied with the specification. We kept adding more and more to it. Because as it becomes real, that creative process, you have these epiphanies. Wow, this does work, but it would be so much better if you changed this or that or the other thing. And so, after a few weeks, yes, we had a rudimentary prototype up for less than a couple thousand dollars. But that was in September of 2004. So the first time people saw Digg on a public website where humans were actually using it was December of 2004. So that's at least a 2-month process that of sort of iteration and reiteration. So probably less than $5,000 had been spent before the site went public. And then from then on, it was a question of how long could we continue to scale the website with this, $99 a month hosting deal and, a garage type operation.
That seems like the big question today. A lot of people have kind of casually gotten into entrepreneurship where, like you said, they just make a commitment to program at night and they start a business. What is that metric? How far can you go with just a few bucks and a cheap server?
Well, if you're only funding one or two people, meaning if there's only one or two people who have to eat based on this, and the site isn't really growing, meaning it gets to some kind of niche-based operation, let's say 20,000 users or something like that, like some blogs get, and the advertising revenue coming in from Google, when properly tweaked, might be enough for you to actually make a living, barely, just barely, and that's if you're popular. But what happens is, if your idea is successful and it starts growing at a you know, sort of Web 2.0 rate and starts to accelerate in any way, there will come a point when, you know, $99 a month hosting, you exceed your bandwidth bill. The number of servers you get for that can't handle the load. The code that you used is not efficient enough to handle the growth. And so you look at this operation and realize, well, if I don't handle the growth, then I'll implode. I'll just basically slow down to a crawl, and then I won't be able to handle users anymore. If I do want to handle the growth, I've got to go get some capital. And that's where angels come in.
So you took this on with Kevin now, and you were working as the CEO. What was that dynamic like? You know, what's Kevin's title now?
Kevin is the founder and chief architect, and I'm the chairman and CEO.
He steal that title from Bill Gates, or?
You know, I doubt very highly that has ever occurred to him. He literally is the chief architect of Dig. He has you have to understand something about Kevin, and this is absolutely critical to the success of Dig. This guy wakes up in the morning, you know, he has a glass of green tea, he gets in the shower, and before he's dried off, he's got his cell phone, and he's calling me with 8 ideas he had between the time that he woke up, had his tea, and got out of the shower. Okay, of which 7 are brilliant innovations, and 1 is dorky. Okay, so this is what he's like every single day. So the challenge for that is, you know, he's not a business guy. So applying these really great ideas to a business, and by the way, not all of them apply to Dig, is really the key, and that's really where the team comes together. When I call him chief architect, you have to understand all the ideas and innovations, buttons, features, formats, views, even to some extent what graphics we've chosen, which have been largely a relationship that we've had with Daniel Burka and Silver Orange. That all comes from Kevin and his brain. It's incredible, his intuition for this stuff. And if it weren't for that intuition, there would be no Dig. And so chief architect is a perfect title for him. He really is the grand poobah of all things Dig. And my goal is to shield him from all the business stuff and just keep that, just so that nothing stifles that creativity under any circumstances. And also, you know, my job is, I think, to protect Kevin from, you know, again, those mistakes that I made through my career.
Now, you're both creative people with a lot of vision. Do your visions ever alter? I mean, even on small things where you think, okay, we should go in this direction, and Kevin thinks we should go in this direction. I mean, that must happen, right?
It does. I mean, I guess the part of this has to do with trust. You know, throughout this entire process, he would come up with some plan or direction for Dig. From time to time, I might disagree with that direction. Usually the way I've approached it with him is, you know, I start from a position of trust, which is if I let Kevin roll and I didn't give him too much restraint, it would probably be great, right? Maybe not the best, but definitely great. So if I start from that position of trust, then the question is guiding, you know, sort of providing some, you know, devil's advocate positioning on whatever the idea might be. I mean, one of the things that we disagreed on, and I'll reveal this, which is, you know, not been told to the public, but it's like I had a different idea of what the new topic should be for Dig when we rolled out Dig 3.0. And he was extremely confident about his choices of the topics because he's so tied in with that community and the audience that Dig talks to. And so the key for me being successful for Dig is yes, I have to play that devil's advocate. And he did make some changes based on that discussion. So he listens to me as well. But it's also my willingness to let go and trust him and his knowledge of that community and empower him, but also to arm him with the ability, you know, and the data and the metrics to know when he may have been wrong. or when a particular direction might be the right direction. And that's not something that he just wakes up with and has in the shower. You know, I had to create an operational team to build the metrics so he could read that and make some decisions. So it's, I think it's a perfect working relationship. I've never had a better one in my life. It is fantastic. It reminds me of the days when Al Avery and I were alone coming up with Equinix, and there was no big corporation, and we were sitting around his swimming pool in San Jose, and we were coming up with ideas. That feeling of empowerment where we're helping each other out is something that was lost at Equinix, and it's something that I really feel I've been able to create with Dig.
And all this despite being, you're in fact in New York right now, and you spend half your time still in New York?
About half, yeah. You know, sometimes I end up having to spend more time out east or out west, depending on where Dig's business is going. Dig does a lot of business with large media companies, and I end up having to be out east anyway. But yeah, we have an office and headquarters in San Francisco, and the agreement with me and my family is, okay, when I'm home, I'm in my home office. I'm a hermit. And when I'm gone, I'm working in Dig HQ. It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, not too many people who get a job like that.
It's a pretty good deal. And as my time is required in person at Dig, I'm there. And, you know, if you go to dig.com and you go to the bottom of the page, there's an About Us section. And if you click on me, it shows me on my cell phone. And it says that, you know, one of my tools to realize my vision and goals for Dig is a cell phone, you know, an incredible staff and video chat. I think I am the poster child for Apple and their iChat AV. I use it every day, all day long. I'm on video chat, and it is the most incredible tool for me.
Wow, this is the first time I've heard someone cite that as a good business tool.
It is the most incredible business tool. I had a staff meeting today with video chat, and we have a staff member who's in Europe who could come in on video chat. It is just incredible. I hate to say it, but you know, the travel industry, the airline industry is in jeopardy because this whole notion of face-to-face can be achieved now, finally, very effectively with video chat. It's not quite as good, but it's good enough for a lot of internal stuff. And so I've been a proud user.
So a year from now, you may be a total hermit. You'll never have to leave your place again, right?
Well, I have a place in San Francisco. I lived in San Francisco for 15 years. I love San Francisco. And, if not for the family concerns and for, you know, really the sort of burnout that was happening, I'd probably still be there. So having an apartment in San Francisco and being able to go back there and live the entrepreneurial lifestyle out there is just amazing. And so, I have a pretty good deal. I don't think I'll ever become a full-time hermit here.
So you were talking about instituting metrics and making wise business decisions off that. Using that, what was the worst business decision you made with Dig, and you know, how'd that affect it? How'd you recognize it? How you correct it?
Wow. Man, okay. Worst business decision I've made at Dig. it may be a little too soon for me to be properly retrospective on bad decisions at Dig, because so far we've been doing pretty good. You know, I haven't made a bad hire. I don't think we've made any bad development decisions. So really it's some of the tactics, perhaps. One of the things that we did at Dig was I know this may sound really lightweight of all the things that you can make bad business decisions on, but we leased some office space in November of 2005. And it took us until May of 2006 to move into that space. And part of the reason is because, you know, we wanted to have this space a particular way, and we wanted to, you know, to not go into one of those cube farms that were pre-built. We really wanted to have something that was conducive to our creativity and to the culture that we've built. But we spent so much time building that office and getting it ready that it cut into our productivity. And I don't know, in retrospect, I wish we hadn't spent so much time and money Brazilian office, and instead we had just found or just, you know, rented some furniture and stuck it in there. You know, it's part of that is me coming from a publicly traded, you know, billion-dollar market cap company into a startup and making that transition again and having some trouble with just accepting a regular office space. But, you know, I know it sounds kind of like you probably want a better mistake, but that's the only one that comes to mind.
That sounds like a good problem to have, not having a great big, huge mistake to cite.
Oh, yeah. Talk to me in a year. I'll have a few more. For sure.
Can you tell me a little more about how you are making money off Dig and how you plan to make money, both your current revenue and also, I know it's an ad model. Is this going to be just like CNN.com where you sell ad units, or is there more to it?
It is as simple as it sounds in that, yes, our revenue stream will be and will always be ads. And as, you know, simple as that is, there's a lot of complexity and secret sauce that goes behind that to make that more effective for us. So if I just throw ads up, you know, Google AdSense, it's not going to work just by itself. There has to be some intelligence. Dig is a very unique site in that we have a lot of visibility into what people's interests are. And one of the questions, you know, and of course, always completely private and never anything but anonymized, is how could we use that data to just, you know, have ads that are better targeted and give us a better CPM. We haven't really done much of that yet, but that's all in the future. Other things are when you go to the videos section or the sports section, we're not using separate ads yet. We don't have separate ad campaigns for those different sections. As crazy as that might seem, we've never done that yet, but that's in the future. And so we'll throw some of that intelligence and secret sauce behind the ad model, but it will always be an ad model.
Who do you view as your biggest competitor?
That's a great question. I think by and large, you know, my biggest competitor probably is someone I haven't met yet or seen. And the reason I say that is because the sites that are really cloning us, that look like us, when you look at their success rate and where they've been able to penetrate, it's really, they haven't even been able to jumpstart their critical mass of growth. And I think largely that's just due to the way we designed our site and also to, you know, the network effect where we've now become so sticky, RSS integrated, it's kind of hard to start a competitor and jump into our space. And why I say it's someone we haven't met yet is because there's always innovations out there. And, you know, our biggest competitor is someone coming up with a better way to rank and do user collaboration before we do. And so, you know, that's what's out there. When I look at names, if you're looking for names of companies that sort of compete in our space, I mean, there's companies like Reddit, Newsvine, Netscape is very famous for having cloned Dig's idea. There's a number of others out there. There's probably several hundred companies that actually have built themselves up on a reverse engineered open source version of Dig that's been released. It doesn't have any of our promotional algorithms and secret stuff and intellectual property behind the scenes, but on the surface, it looks kind of similar. And so a lot of sites have tried to clone us doing that. None of these sites have really been successful from the standpoint that Dig has. So, you know, again, it's kind of hard for me to answer that question.
Now, I can't help to talk about Netscape just because there's been so much publicity about it, where Jason Calacanis, who was acquired by, in his company, Weblogs Inc., acquired by AOL, took the old Netscape name and launched something that looks very similar to Dig on it. So what was your reaction when you first saw it? And then also, how have you been responding as he's been trying to grow his company through tactics like trying to pay some of your top users to submit their stories to his site rather than to your site?
Well, I guess overall, my initial impression was utter surprise, and I'll tell you why. Jason had been interacting with Dig for since Dig's inception. Jason's known Kevin for a long time. He's he was a supporter of Dig Weblogs. You know, he talked to us about ways to interconnect Weblogs with Dig. So I knew that there had been rumors for about 3 months that Netscape was doing that, but I have to admit, I was kind of thinking that there's no way that they would do something that was so obvious a copy as to clone Dig. So my first response that very moment, that morning when I first looked at the beta, was just utter shock. I mean, they even copied the look and feel of like the buttons, and it was just really strange for a company as big as Time Warner to do that. Now, that being said, kudos to AOL Time Warner, because they're realizing, and they realized, that user collaboration is the future, and it is the way to make a news portal, and it is the way to go. I guess what I would have much rather seen was more of a partnership type of relationship, where they produce the content through their giant content provider and their users submit it to Dig, rather than try and create a isolated community. That's been overall, I really can't criticize Jason. I think he's brilliant in his own way. I think he saw the future in user collaboration, and he tried to apply it to the company he worked for. I don't agree with some of the choices he's made. That's a subjective opinion. I don't believe in layering a editorial hierarchy over Dig. I think that destroys the level playing field that Dig has created. I don't agree with buying the top diggers. I think that also is just a bad move. I mean, Dig cycles our top users pretty regularly. It's certainly monthly. We have new top diggers all the time. You take our top 20 submitters and put them over at Netscape, maybe you'll get some better submissions, but it doesn't change the fact that you need diggers to dig those submissions in order for it to work. And you have to remove that hierarchical layer of editorial for it to be a level playing field. So I just don't know what he's trying to achieve. He's very, very strongly opinionated on this, and I think he's entitled to that opinion, and best of luck to Netscape.
Now, he still refers to you and Kevin as his friend in his blog. Do you guys still hang out, chat about this stuff over beers? Or
To be fair, I've never actually met Jason, just to be honest.
Have you at least video chatted with him, or not yet?
I haven't actually video chatted with him. I've actually never talked to him in person. I know that sounds really bad, but the truth is that his relationship has mostly been with Kevin, and that's been mostly over Instant Messenger. I think they've probably been on a panel or two together over time. They certainly had a relationship already that was at least via email a couple of years ago. And I've seen some of this discussion, and I've always actually wanted to engage with him. It just hasn't happened yet. I certainly would have a beer with him, but it just, hasn't happened yet. Don't get me wrong. I would love to. I think he's really an interesting guy. I'd love to talk about a million things with that guy, and I have every reason to do so as soon as the fates allow it.
Well, hopefully he's listening to the podcast.
Yeah, if he's listening to this podcast, hey, Jason, let's have a beer, man. I'm ready.
All right, well, be sure to relay that. So just jumping ahead, though, I think it is kind of an interesting idea that for some kind of user-generated content or whatever you want to call it, like writing blog entries, there seems to be a market for that. Do you think that, let's say your competitors start plowing budgets into hiring away people who are submitting links, do you think that what people do on your website there can ever be a market for, or is this just something totally different than that?
Well, I think there's a market for writing good journalism, and there's a market for good blogs and so on. So there's value to the content. There is value to the users contributing, and bringing those things that others have written to the community.
In essence, they're the editors, right?
Right. It's, the difference is basically sort of an editor model again. And so I guess the difference that I have is who I believe should be compensated for it. You know, I think that in order for a democratic sort of global community to work, you can't really compensate those who are participating because it forces a hierarchical model into the system. A good analogy would be, I can't pay someone to vote for president, right? It's their right to vote, right? It's their privilege to vote. But it's not something that I can pay them for, because the second I do that, then what I'm doing, first of all, is I'm creating a system that really has trouble scaling. That goes without saying. But secondly, it also establishes ranking. Already, you know, the question comes up all the time, where are these top 20 diggers, you know, they work so hard for dig, should they not be compensated? I just think that the reason for their top digging has to be passion and belief in sharing their ideas with the community. It really can't be because it's a vocation. Can somebody make a job out of it? Sure, they should go to Netscape, and they should get paid $1,000 a month to surf the net and to find stuff. They should be paid to be an editor. That's not what Dig does. Dig is talking about, you know, is the level playing field and the individuals. So I guess my long answer to that question really comes down to no, I don't believe that we should be compensating any Dig user for their participation.
What strikes me about Dig as a company is that the user base is so emotional and so passionate. You know, you can see when there are changes made, very strong opinions, even when competitors came up, people doing lots of opinions. And I imagine that's very different than the other ventures you've been involved with. I mean, I'm sure people were passionate about it, but they weren't posting all over the internet that your company's better than a competitor or not, or getting upset or delighted with a new feature. You know, there's just something about this that seems so much more personal about this business. Have you noticed that? And does it affect the way you run this business?
Well, it absolutely affects the way that we run this business. And so, yes, I've noticed it. And yes, it affects us. We believe that our changes and our direction have come from those very users. The users were telling us they wanted politics and they wanted sports back in January of 2005, or 2006, rather. So we knew, no, 2005, excuse me. And we knew for a year that we would be expanding into these areas based on what the users have given us. Their feedback on UI has been hugely influential on what decisions we make. We know we can't please everyone, right? Because you're making a site for 1 million unique visitors a day. You can't please all 1 million. There's going to have to be some compromise, but it does influence a lot. What I really love about the Dig community is there's so much intelligence in there. We got a lot of criticism about, you know, trolls and people on the who are commenting that rules and that'd be it. But more prevalent was the thoughtful response, the opinionated response that you're referring to. And that was so useful to us. Imagine how useful that is to you running a business to have this direct connection to your audience every single day, every single minute in the form of digs and comments. It's a complete blessing. So, in previous companies, well, first of all, there was no interactive collaborative web, even in 1998. The technologies were there, yes, to all the people listening to this podcast. Yes, I know, Dynamic XML. I know it's all been there for a long time. I'm not talking about the technology. I'm talking about user acceptance. The user acceptance for that kind of collaboration was slow in coming. It wasn't until, 99, 2000, you saw websites like, F the Company and other, things come out where you really saw this interesting collaboration, people sharing their ideas and Friendster and LinkedIn, even more important was LinkedIn, and just this sort of acceptance. So the environment for that feedback loop hasn't existed until now. And I'm just so proud of Dig for being able to harness it. Yes, we made the cover of Business Week. We're very proud of that too, but just for everyone listening out there, Kevin Rose did not make $60 million. He does not have that cash. that was completely invented, and the valuation of DIG is completely speculative. And but we are extremely excited and proud and very grateful to Business Week for featuring us. It's generated a lot of controversy, that article on its own.
You just stole my next question. Was going to be about that valuation. They said he was worth $60 million. He kept 30. I think they were estimating that he held on to about 30-40% of the company, and that Valley insiders, whoever those are, value the company around $200 million.
I don't know. Sounds good to me. I really can't comment one way or the other on the valuation and sort of where they came up with it. I think the bottom line is, what are people willing to pay for DIG right now? Well, no one's buying DIG, and no one's made an offer for DIG, so it is complete guesswork on the part of Business Week, as is the revenues that they're estimating, complete guesswork. Our focus is on features, users, and growth. And, we tell people how we're growing, like 1 million unique visitors a day or whatever it is, but we certainly don't publish our revenues.
I imagine you'll use that, though, next time you're talking with venture capitalists, right?
Well, what is DIG's next step? One of the questions that we're still asking internally is what our next investment step is, mainly just because we raised enough money, $2.8 million we raised in September, October of 2005. It's really enough to get us to, cash flow positive. It's not the way I necessarily want to go cash flow positive. I think I'd like to hire, 10 developers more and get features out 10 times faster. And that would increase my burn rate, and so I'd have to go raise some more cash. But, it's really up in the air how we go about doing that.
That sounds like a big question. I imagine you must feel a little bit of pressure. I mean, a lot of guys are raising a lot of money right now. You've seen before, the market for that is cyclic. It must be pretty tempting to just go out and raise a whole bunch of money right now.
I have to be honest with you, and maybe this is my, naivete, but it's like I'm not feeling the pressure. My investors that I have aren't pressuring me. The cash burn isn't pressuring me. I think there'll be capital out there this year. I think there'll be capital out there next year. Where I get it from might be different. It might be corporate or venture or whatever, what form of institutional. But, right now I'm not feeling that pain. I think the reason to go raise money would be because we change our business plan and increase our burn rate to a point where it's just the prudent thing to do. And even if we do it, it's not going to be much. It won't be much because it's just, we don't have a high cost business. People will go out there and raise like, $15 or $20 million because they can. My question to these people is, what are you thinking? What's the point? Unless your business plan really requires that kind of cash, why would you sell that part of your company away? Is this not, this is logic, right?
It makes sense. And, I'm really curious too, like talking about kind of your vision for the company and Kevin and the rest of the team, do you see this as a type of thing where like with your last company, it can IPO and just be this great big business on its own, like the current media companies? Or are you looking more at kind of, this cliche Web 2.0 company where you sell to Yahoo for $30 million or some nice amount without having to raise that much money?
Well, I have to admit, I kind of resent the, the community for forcing me to pick. Your question is perfectly right on. But it's just, I've what happened in the days where I can just focus on building a business, a fundamentally solid business that was structurally sound, had a long-term profitability game, that was just a good company. With, investors want an exit strategy eventually. I understand that, but, there's private equity and public equity, right? When Equinix went public, it was like putting on giant, handcuffs and just chaining us down because suddenly we had this huge overhead of reporting, this responsibility to the shareholders and growing your revenue at rates that were that really were, and sometimes, unnecessary for the company's solvency. You know, sometimes that's not true. I mean, you know, Equinix was had to get to profitability first, and that was a good, certainly a good goal. But the pressure of a publicly traded company is just insane. It's why Google resisted for as long as they did, and I applaud that decision. As far as IPO, then, you know, if we need the money, that kind of capital that an IPO brings, if the business requires that kind of money, and that's a, you know, a financial decision, then that's why to go public. Don't see it. Don't see that in the future. Don't see any need to do it. But it could happen one day. Who knows? As far as acquisition is concerned, you know, our attitude at Dig is really simple. The reason to merge with another company or be acquired by another company is if the merger of us plus that other company allows us to get to our goals for the company, you know, 10 times better than what we do it alone. It's a very simple, you know, strategic decision to do so. You know, we're not going to sell the company so Kevin can have $60 million in his pocket. If Kevin needs money or we need money, there's all sorts of things you can do privately to get to that point without selling the company. There's ways to achieve that. Now with that said, we've seen some real exciting ideas out there, of companies out there that, you know, are doing some cool things that have combined with Dig is really exciting and might actually get us there. So it's not a crazy idea for us to be acquired. It's just that that discussion at that level of sophistication has not happened yet, and we're not knocking on doors.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess as you're saying, it's something that seems it's a question that's getting forced upon more and more companies earlier and earlier.
It's unfair. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I think, you know, if wealth is your goal, okay, even if wealth is your goal, and you want to be successful in that way, then really what you need to do is you need to focus on execution and focus on making your business the best thing out there. And you know what? The revenue will follow and then the wealth will follow. You know, to focus on the end game so quickly is often a mistake. Now, on the flip side, if your company is a flash in a pan and you think that whatever your model is right now has limits, you know, on its own, and can't survive on its own, and somebody comes along and offers you, you know, an exit, take it by all means, take it right away. Get some, I'm the first person to support that decision. I mean, at Equinix, I never sold my stock, and oops, oh well, you know, lost that opportunity. And so, you know, I finally, after I'm in this position where I absolutely understand, you know, if that's the case, but I'm also the CEO of a business, and my job is to make sure that we make the best business decisions, not what's going to be best for the pocketbook for myself and Kevin.
That's a great attitude. So I just want to get a sense now of where this is all going, and we didn't get too much time to talk about Revision 3, but I'd love to hear a little bit about that. But why don't you tell me how you're going to spend your next 2 weeks? Like, what are your biggest priorities? How much time are you spending on hiring, on fundraising, on strategy, on product? You know, what's your life look like?
Okay, so Dig, right now, everybody working on, you know, 24/7, the next features that we've already planned out 3 months ago that are in the hopper. Some exciting new sections for the site that I won't go into too much detail on, but that we really think are revolutionary in their own way.
Can you give us any preview?
The best I can tell you is Dig as a concept can be applied to other content besides news, and just wait and see what we're going to apply it to.
Like shopping, deals.
Could be. And you know, the beauty of it is that we've got this incredible team. We haven't been hiring. We're about 15. Actually, we're in September. We'll be 17. But we're growing fast from the standpoint of needs. So I anticipate hiring some more developers over the course of the next few months. So, you know, big PHP geniuses, we love you. Send us your resumes. But it's all about product. It's all about innovation. Business development, spend some more time on that. You'll probably see over the next few weeks more dig buttons pop up on other people's websites as a result of some of this. You know, and that's my number one priority is managing that at Dig. I'd say my number two priority is right now, this very second, is Revision 3, just because I'm closing a round of funding for Revision 3 right now, and that's an extremely exciting business for me as well. Albeit I'm just chairman and interim CEO, we're looking for a CEO for that company. We're really excited about where that one's going.
So that's a company that's totally content?
Totally content, but more importantly, it's content who already has an audience, who already has, I mean, our number one show, which is called Dig Nation, already has 300,000 viewers, 250,000, 300,000 viewers a week. It does better than many niche cable stations do. You know, this is the new media. This is the convergence of television and internet, finally. And it's exciting. It's, you know, the knowledge to be able to work with an infinite number of distribution platforms and the, you know, sort of the talent behind that. That's what Revision 3 already has. And so the question now is, you know, we got to this point where it was a hobby on weekends and it's become a, you know, cash flow positive business, and it's really time to grow it. We're at that stage where now the interest is coming in at a greater rate than we can support it with the capital that we have. And we need to get over that hump by raising some capital and growing the business.
How big is that round going to be?
Oh, it's an angel round. We're going to keep it nice and small. Certainly nothing VC-sized.
Growing very young, and I won't ask you what your exit plan is for that business.
Oh, man, it's the same answer. It's the same answer as Dig. You know, we're so excited. You have to understand is that when the Dig employees come to work every day, we are just so psyched to be there. We are just so happy to be able to do our jobs, and we derive such happiness out of it that it's almost a harsh on our you know, euphoria to start thinking about exits and other companies and all that kind of thing. And I think Revision 3 is like that as well. These guys love making content. They love making Martin Sargent, who makes Infected, you know, this kind of off the wall, hopefully offensive television or video or audio podcast. You know, he has a good time making it. And, you know, my wife is in hysterics listening to it. Isn't that all that matters? You know, I want to make sure he makes money doing it, though. And that's the goal of Revision 3, is to enable this content, allow these people to do this and make a living.
Great. Well, that's all of my questions. Do you have any, you said you like to give advice to Kevin and other budding entrepreneurs. Do you have any advice for people out there who are looking at Dig saying, what a great business. I want to be that dangerous person who might be the next Dig or at least some other great company I can build very efficiently.
Oh, go for it. The number one thing is don't wait. You know, don't write it all down and then go shop it to a million VCs. Just execute on it. It doesn't cost the money it used to. So if you can, find somebody out there. If you're not a programmer and you need a programmer to create something, you know, surf around the net. Find someone. Go to elance.com, you know, and hire someone to program this thing for you. Just go. Instead of asking the question and doubting, just execute. And if it really is a good idea, it'll catch on, and then the money and the capital investments will follow. And that's my recommendation, is just don't hesitate. Don't let the industry convince you that you know, it's 1 in 10. Don't worry about that. You're probably that 1 in 10, and you just need to go execute on it.
Well, if you're listening to Venture Voice, they must be. Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Jay.
Yeah, it was my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
That's all for this edition of Venture Voice. If you want to experience Dig, go to dig.com, search for this story, and click on Dig. By clicking Dig, you can push this podcast up to the top of their site and experience the full effect that Jay's talking about. It gets pretty addictive. If you have comments about this show, make sure you pop over to venturevoice.com. We want to hear what you have to say. You can leave a comment for everyone to see, or you can send us a private message through the contact form, or even contact us through our listener line, which you can find on the website. Stay tuned for more Venture Voice. We just moved into new offices in New York City, and we are ramping up to make many more great shows for you. We look forward to staying in touch with you all. Until next time, this is Venture Voice, entertaining entrepreneurship.